My name is John Holmes, and I'm a very grateful recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I am deeply touched to have this opportunity to spend this weekend with many of you who I know and have touched my life. This is very difficult for me this morning because this is a tough act to follow. My dear sweet wife, you know, was the Thursday night speaker, and I was prepared just to be her driver. And that's not the way it turned out. I got a telephone call a few weeks ago and was asked if I could substitute for the Sunday morning speaker who incurred some illness. And I said, "Sunday morning? Me? Spiritual speaker? You really need to look around." But they said no, the committee was unanimous in wanting you to come and share. And I said, "I will do the best I can." You know, Ralph started out on Friday night talking about in the city of Los Angeles in the Watts area. And as my story develops, I'll tell you the similarities. Ralph knows those similarities. And you know that Saturday morning was my great treat. I've heard Bob's tape. And the son of our co-founder. You know, what a treasure. And the thing that I appreciate so much about Bob is his wonderful sense of humor. And I know that he inherited that from two wonderful people, his mother Ann and his father Dr. Bob. And we had an old-timers panel yesterday afternoon, and I don't know what I was doing up there with those old people. I might just tell you something about him, too. And last night, Angie, God love her. She is such a wonderful inspiration. She's a very powerful lady. And you know, she just mentioned just briefly, 42 years ago, I made a 12-step call on her husband. But what she didn't tell you was that I threw him out of the car. And the reason that I did that is that he's just a little guy, and she uses the word pachuco, you know, as being a tough guy. He was not big enough to be a tough guy. That's the reason he got kicked out of the car. And then they asked me to do this morning. And it's tough, folks. That's a tough act to follow. But I'm going to do the best that I possibly can in the 3 hours that they have given me. The reason, too, that I tell you that it's difficult, you know, I get asked every once in a while to go someplace else and speak. Maybe to Omaha or California or someplace else to speak. And that's pretty easy to do. Folks, there's a lot of people in this audience that I have had a part in their life, and they've had a part in my life. And you know, when you talk to the people where you really live, It's more difficult than talking to strangers. There are people sitting in this audience that are closer to me than my own brothers, that I know all the parts of their life, their children, their parents, their extended family. What a great privilege that is. See, I got that privilege here. What I want to do is I want to try to capsulize today, because you know, sometimes what seems to happen to me, and I don't know why, I only drank for 9 years, but sometimes I get trapped in talking about that 9 years. Folks, I've had 44 years of recovery. There's a lot more to talk about in recovery than there was in drunk. So what I'm going to try to do today, if I can, is I'm going to try to talk to you about the recovery part. Because I'm not going to have much to say or teach anybody about drinking. I didn't do very well at it myself. But I think what I'm going to try to do today, if I can, and you'll bear with me, I'm going to start the day I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, that very morning. You know, I was a very ambitious young guy. I had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, and I'd gotten involved in an alcoholic marriage that was disastrous. And I had been working for the Los Angeles Times, and I had a good job, folks. But like many of the rest of us, what I did is I drank it away. Now, if you work for a newspaper and you're a drunk, you could stay there for years. But I managed to get fired. And I was in desperate straits in my life. And as I made my way home from the Los Angeles Times back out to this little town of La Puente, it's kind of like suburban Skid Row is what it is. At least the part I lived in. And as I drove up in that little street in this little drunk car that I had, that little family, I had two little kids and a terrified wife, and they were piling up the furniture in this little truck to leave and go back and live with their parents. You see, I destroyed that too. And you know what the thought I had at the time? Good riddance. You know, now I'll be able to drink the way I want to drink. And I turned around and tried to decide what I was going to do. And in California, they have a strange thing they do when you don't pay for a house. They come and they board it up, the windows and doors. They won't even give you entrance into the place. And that's what they were in the process of doing. And I had my little car and I drove off. Had that little check, though, in my pocket, my last check from the Los Angeles Times. And I was trying to decide what I was going to do. And I came to the momentous decision that what I was going to do is I was going to take up housekeeping in the car. And I had a couple of friends of mine who were going to spend some time with me in that car, and their names were Ernest and Julio Gallo. So I took residence up in the car with Ernest and Julio. I really don't know how long I stayed there. I was parked in a little area in an orange grove, and I was off the street, I guess. And I guess today I'd be called homeless, except I had the car. The repossessor just hadn't found it yet, that's all. So what I did is I took up residence in the car, and I was in terrible shape, folks. You know, you take an Irishman drinking sweet wine, and they look like a mess. You know, I was all bloated, and I had little slits for eyes, and I was in terrible physical condition. I was in terrible shape. But the most terrible shape I was in was on the inside. You see, I had lived contrary to the way that I was raised, and I paid a horrible price for that. I came from a very functional family. My folks were not alcoholic. My folks didn't even drink. I had three brothers, two that preceded me and one that followed me. God bless the one that followed me. And you know what? They were all pretty normal. Happy family. We're going to talk about spiritual things a bit this morning. I want to start in that area. You know, when I was a little kid growing up in this family, I loved my mom and dad. I loved my brothers. We went to church. I had my place in church and I had my God. And you know, for a little kid, it was just fine. I was okay with that. I was pretty comfortable with it. And folks, I want to tell you something. I was 15 years old. I took my first drink. And my opinion, looking back in my life, is that was the first separation from God, was that first drink. Because it was going to take me on a path that was totally contrary to the way that I was raised. Because I could do whatever I wanted to do. When everybody else went off to college, I went in the Marine Corps. And the reason I did is because I wasn't ready to go to college. I was no more material for college than the man in the moon. I needed to go into the service. I spent 3 years in the Marine Corps, and it was a good part of my life. It wasn't all drunk. I was a pretty decent Marine, and it was a very good part of my life. And when I got out, what I did is I just picked up right where I left off. And as I started taking up housekeeping that car, my life was a shambles. Absolute shambles. And I was in desperation, folks. You know, many people have said, well, why didn't you go back home to Pennsylvania, to your mother and dad? Why in God's name would I want to inject me on those poor people? I didn't want to do that. And you know, I just got worse. I couldn't distinguish evening from morning. I didn't know whether the sun was coming up or the sun was going down. I didn't know whether it was morning or evening or night or afternoon, and I didn't care. All I wanted to do was to make sure that I had something else to drink to take the pain away. And one morning I woke up, and it's my belief, standing here before you today, that my spiritual experience took place that morning. I rolled out of that car sometime right around sunset, I think. And I was on my knees outside that little car throwing up blood. I've been doing that for a long time. I just thought that was par for the course. And I realized that in my despair, I couldn't go any further. Not one step further. And I cried out in desperation, please, God, help me. And it was like all the tapes and everything stopped for a brief moment. And in that brief moment, my message was, call Alcoholics Anonymous. And folks, I want to tell you right now, I never read, heard, or seen anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know anything about you people. And I was in such a state that I didn't even question it. I just got myself cleaned up and headed that little drunk car for Los Angeles. And I went into a drugstore. And I called information for the number for Alcoholics Anonymous. And she must have heard the desperation in my voice because she didn't give me the number. She connected me with Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a lady answering, and her name was Sybil. And she listened to my little story, which she must have heard thousands of them just like it. And she said to me, there's a place on Southwestern Avenue called the Southwest Alano Club. And if you can make your way there, there'll be somebody there to talk to you. And I said, I can find it. And I went over to this little storefront in Watts on Western Avenue. And just about at the time I was going to walk up to the door, somebody opened it from the inside. There was a little guy standing there. He's about this tall, stringy hair, got little hexagon glasses on. Stuck out his hand. He said, "My name is Joe." He said, "What's yours?" I was pretty sad. I was a pretty sad looking character. 24 years old. And I was at the end of my road. And I was totally, absolutely desperate. And I want to tell you something else, folks. Many people said, "Well, I don't know if I'm an alcoholic or I don't know if I have a problem or not." I knew I had a problem. And I knew what the problem was. I just didn't think there was any kind of solution. I thought that God had picked me out to be hopeless. That's what I felt. And this man stuck his hand out and he shook my hand. And he asked me, he told me later that I asked him two questions. I don't remember this. But this is what he said. He said, "You stuck your hand out and you said, 'How do I become a member and how much are the dues?'" And he said, "My answer to you was that if you step across that threshold, you can become a member here." And he said, "Sonny," he said, "as far as the dues are concerned, it's apparent that you've already paid yours." And I entered the doors of Southwest Alano Club, which was Alcoholics Anonymous to me. You see, I was so sick. I was so sick. I thought the Southwest Alano Club was the only place that AA was in Los Angeles. I really did. And it was a place that wasn't quite as fancy as the ones we see today. The date was April the 9th of 1959. And I was desperate. In this little Southwest Alano Club, they had a place upstairs that they kept the sick drunks. Those were the people in paper slippers. And they would shuffle down the steps in their paper slippers to come to the meetings downstairs. And I remember that first day that I was so sick and nothing really seemed to make any sense to me. Except when I left to go back out to that orange grove, because I didn't have any place else to go, I had hope for the first time in my life. Hope is what I left there with. You see, these people accepted me exactly where I was. They didn't ask me any questions about what kind of job I had or what kind of family. They didn't ask it. They said, "If you have a problem, you are welcome here." And I want to warn you folks about one thing, because this is very near and dear to my heart. There wasn't a single solitary soul in that Southwestern Alano Club that said to me, "Hey kid, you're too young to be an alcoholic." Where in God's name could I go if they said, "You're too young, you can't stay here"? Back to the orange grove to die in my own puke? I think it's important that we welcome people in to share the same kind of recovery that's been offered to us. And that little guy, he was my temporary sponsor. He had an old Chevrolet and he took six people to meetings. When you were the newcomer, you sat on the hump in the back seat. And then you gradually worked your way up to the outside where the window was on the driver's. It was by seniority. You're 30 days sober, you're out of there. And we went to a lot of meetings. I want to tell you something else. I want you to think about this in relationship to today. In Los Angeles, in 1959, when he would haul us to meetings, they used to have what they call newcomers row. Be right along the wall. Every meeting we went to, newcomers row. They put you over there. They said, "Is anybody here that's new? Raise your hand." They didn't want to hear a sound out of you. First 30 days in this program, you did not speak. Not a bad idea. I remember saying to Joe Moats, when am I going to get a chance to speak in Alcoholics Anonymous? He had that little snarl on his face, and he said, what the hell would you have of any value to anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous? Really hurt my feeling. And you know what? 30 days went by, and I noticed that there's some people that normally don't come to that meeting, and they're in the Southwest Delano Club. And Joe Moats takes me by the arm and marches me over to this guy, and he said, this guy's name is Howdy. He's going to be your sponsor. Can you imagine that happening today, folks? What if I can't relate to him? Never entered my mind. He said to me, my name is Howdy. He said, what's yours? And I said, it's John. He said, where do you live? That was my first test. How do I tell this guy I'm living in my car? But you know what? I'm trapped. I have to tell him. You know what he said to me? He said, you're not living in your car anymore. He said, you're coming home with me. And I went home to live in his basement. I thought I'd gone to heaven. Had a bed, had a toilet, had a sink, and I had a shower. You know, one of those metal showers? Had that little white thing that you try to close. Can't turn around in there, but you know, it's almost like you have to step out, turn around, and get back in it again. Folks, I thought it was wonderful. I did. I thought it was wonderful. And I had a radio. That was uptown. I didn't have any radio. The one didn't work in the car. And you know what? I became his landscaper and pool person to take care of his pool. And I settled in, and I really got comfortable. He'd go off to work every day. I had the best tan that you ever saw. You know, I swam laps in the pool every day. And if you're 24 years old and you're getting sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, what happens to you is that you get looking good quickly, physically recovering. And you could get looking good on the outside. But you know what? There's a little bit of danger in there, too. And the reason that there's danger in there is because my real sickness, folks, was on the inside, not on the outside. I could always kind of bounce back and look pretty good on the outside. It's the inside job, folks, is where the real work takes place. Because you see, that's where God lives. God lives on the inside. And I didn't think that God wanted anything to do with me. So what I was doing is I was just going through my little routines every day. And people lately have asked me, they said, when you got sober, John, did they talk about 90 and 90? I never heard the term. We just went to a meeting every night. That kind of took care of itself. He'd come home from work, we would eat dinner, and we'd go to a meeting. Howdy, my first sponsor, God love him, thought the best job in Alcoholics Anonymous was making coffee. And we made a lot of coffee. And we washed cups. They didn't have styrofoam in those days. Some great AA took place there. And you know what he did? He started me through the steps. And what we did, he and I together, we did the first three steps in Alcoholics Anonymous together. But you know what? That's as far as I went. And people said, well, you needed to move on to step four. I was incapable of moving on to step four. I was incapable. Because you see, I thought the things that I had done in my life, that I was not worthy enough for God's attention, and certainly I did not want to write down those things that I had done, because it was painful for me. And I was afraid that when I revealed myself to you, that you would turn from me in disgust and say, I need to get away from this guy. I don't think I'm much different than a lot of other people in this program who had the same kind of feelings. And one of the things that happened to me is it took me a while in Alcoholics Anonymous to take that fourth step. But I believe that that's a doorway to recovery, because that is the first time that we are asked to do something that's really physical in order to clean up the wreckage of our past. Now, I want you to know, folks, I had a lot of wreckage. You know, I had two kids, no job, and my life was a shambles. I had no communication with my mother and dad or my brothers because I could not communicate with them because of my alcoholism. I was so sick and I was isolated from my family. One of the things that he said to me after I had been there for 2 months, he said to me, John, he said, I need you to go down to the Los Angeles Times and make amends to those people. God. If he said to me, I'd like you to cut your left arm off at the elbow, it would have sounded much better than the thing he just asked me to do. I didn't want to do that, folks. I didn't want to go down there and face those people. He said to me, I didn't ask you whether you want it to or not. I want you to go do it. So I got in my little drunk's car, which I still had, cleaned up a little bit, but the Ernest and Julio odor was still in there. And I drove down to the Los Angeles Times. And I went up to see a non-alcoholic by the name of Paul Mahoney, the guy I worked for, the guy who fired me. And I told him exactly what my sponsor told me to tell him. And you know what happened? He said, how would you like your job back? God, just about fell off the chair. See, I didn't go there looking for that. I went there to make amends, to try to make amends for the mess that I had made. And he said, don't think we're doing you any favors. We tried some other people on that territory and you had it so screwed up nobody could make a living. So I went back to work for the Los Angeles Times. And folks, things were good. They were really good. I went to work every day. And I went and I worked hard. And I went to meetings all the time. Lots of meetings. And I was beginning to find my place in Alcoholics Anonymous. But there was a lot of things left undone yet. Came the time I had to move out of my sponsor's basement. That was a sad time for me. And I had this little apartment. This is really it. Street. It was in Chino, California, my little apartment. And I tried to get when I moved into the apartment, you know, this is typical AA's, you know, it was all on donated things. You know, I had rattan furniture and a half of a bed from one person and a mattress from somebody else and a box spring from over here. And, you know, it takes place the same way today. And I finally got it all situated and I wanted to get a telephone. Well, there was a misunderstanding with Pacific Bell. They wouldn't let me have a telephone. So it was on an alley, this little apartment was on an alley, and there was a payphone at the end of the alley, And I had one of my guys in the program turn the ringer up on the payphone. And I would say to people, I lived in that place for 2 years. I'd say to people, here's the telephone number and call me. But sometimes it takes me a while to get to the phone. So, just let it ring. And life was good. Life was good. And I started to meet a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've always been very active. And I've always been a meeting goer because, meeting makers make it. That's my feeling. I heard that someplace and I thought it was real good. I made a lot of really dear friends in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was a very busy guy. I was always on the go. And my work at the Los Angeles Times was going along fine. As a matter of fact, I had a halfway decent relationship with my ex-wife and those two kids. And I finally got to the point where I could afford to get, you can always tell when people are getting sober and they start looking pretty good. They usually become either secretary of the group or they get a new car. One of the two. That's how you can judge about how well they're doing. That's the way I looked at it. I thought that. And I got rid of that little drunk's car and I bought a sports car. Man, I'll tell you, it was a TR3. And once again, I thought that it was the greatest automobile in the world. And I was, I never had a top on. I had three tops. I had a cloth top. I had a hard top, a soft top, and a tonneau cover. And the only thing I ever put on it was a tonneau cover. Because in Southern California, what the hell, is it going to rain for a little while? No big deal. Just speed up a little more, I want to tell you what happened to me during this period of time, because this is an indication about where I was. I was driving in the San Bernardino Freeway in my little TR3. And I'm tooling on down the road. Five lanes of traffic, everybody's doing 70 miles an hour. You're looking over here, you're looking over here, and traffic going down the road. All of a sudden, I noticed the person on my left and the person on my right, they were looking at me kind of strange-like. And you know what I realized? I realized that I had the radio on, and I was singing at the top of my voice. And my voice is terrible. But, folks, that voice that was singing was a voice of joy. Joy about being sober. Joy about having some people in my life that I cared about. And people in my life who cared about me. And I was on top of the world. And life was good. And life was full. And you know what? I thought to myself that what I really needed to do is I needed to make money. That's what I needed to do. And that was the time in my life when I decided that what I was going to do is I was going to make some money. And I set about doing that. I let it become important to me. Sometimes I think I let it become too important to me. Because you see, if you place anything else in front of God, you're going to have to lose something else. And that's the trek that I was on at that time. And I continued that trek. I had a wonderful jobs, made a lot of money. But you know what? I didn't feel real good on the inside. Because, folks, there was a lot of things undone yet in my life. I went to work for this company in Wisconsin. And here I was, 4 or 5 years sober. I was working in the West Coast, lived down at the beach. My territory was the 11 Western states and Hawaii. A lot of problems in Hawaii. I had no boss. My boss was 2,500 miles away. They sent me a whole bunch of credit cards. And I was going to AA meetings and traveling all over. I remember people complaining. They said, I hate this traveling. I thought, what the hell's wrong with you? You know, somebody else is paying for the hotels, paying for the food. I'm going to AA meetings in Hawaii and Maui and Portland and, you know, Seattle, all over the place. I thought this was, I was single. The company said, you want to stay over the weekend and, you know, and you're in Hawaii? They could care less, as long as you got your work done. It was a time in my life, it was in the 60s. Somebody said to me, what were you, you know, what were things like in the 60s? I said, hell, I don't know, I was working. You know, I was working. And I was in AA, I wasn't going to any concerts. And life was really good. Piled up a lot of money. Tremendous amount of money. Still didn't have that really good feeling in here. Then the thing that happens, you know, this is the great alcoholic making the great decisions. The company I worked for in Wisconsin bought a big place out on Palm Desert Golf Course, right along the course, bought a home. They said, we want you to come out and we're going to meet with you. I thought, geez, you know, here it goes. You know, I did something. I went out to meet with them and they said, we want you to become the vice president of sales back in. We want you to run our whole sales organization, not just the West Coast. Boy, I was 30 years old. And I thought to myself, you know, this, I can't believe this. But I did warn you, I certainly didn't want to go live in Wisconsin. But you know what? They kept raising the ante. And you remember what I said to you before? I'm a guy that you raise that ante high enough and you get my attention. Now I want to tell you about the great decision that I was about to make in my life. 7 years sober. 7 years sober, this decision takes place. If I'm going to move back to Wisconsin and I'm going to be an executive, an officer of the company, then I should have a family. How's that for alcoholic thinking? So I find this lady with 3 children. Convince this poor soul that what we're going to do is we're going to get married and this is going to be great bliss and we're going to move back to Wisconsin on this farm with 3 children, 2 dogs, a cat, and 2 horses back to Wisconsin. And you know what? All that decision making was mine. And I want to tell you a little secret, folks. Never, ever mention it to my sponsor. And you know the reason why I never mentioned it to my sponsor. Self will run riot sober. Made the move to Wisconsin. I remember calling my sponsor and said to him, after things quieted down between us, I said, I don't like the meetings here. He said, was there anybody sober in Wisconsin before you got there? He said, if you're really unhappy, go start your own meeting, which I did. I think it's still in existence. But you know what, folks? The winters took their toll, not only on me, but also on that little family. Because you see, it was my decision to bring those innocent bystanders into this marriage. 3 kids and this lady. And you know what? There was a lot of problems. Tremendous amount of problems. My business career skyrocketed. My personal life was in the dumper. And people in AA, I went to meetings, still went to meetings all over the country. But you know what I was, folks? Be careful of this term. I was a visitor in AA. I would visit meetings. I wasn't a part of, I was a visitor in AA. And I began to develop the same kind of soul sickness, sober, that many of us do drunk. And I'm not proud of this part of my life, but I think it's important that you know all about me, not just what you see recently, but all about me. So a lot of things I did during that period of time that I'm not proud of. A lot of things that hurt a lot of other people. And I did this without a drink. After 5 years in Wisconsin, I met a fella, and what we're going to do is we're going to start a business here in Atlanta. We moved the whole family and opened a business in Norcross with this other friend of mine, and he lived over here in Dunwoody. And it was a very successful business. I had a lot of contacts. He had a lot of contacts. I was kind of Mr. Outside. He was kind of Mr. Inside. And I was still kind of, you know, playing my part in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I wouldn't want to tell you what was going on in my own personal life. I wouldn't want to stand up here and tell you, because it was not a spiritual life. I tell you because I had that feeling inside, is that I would go to AA meetings and I would see other people recovering, and what I was doing is I was staying sick. But you couldn't see that from the outside, because my great sickness, folks, was on the inside. One of the things that happened, we were in business in Atlanta for 7 years, and finally that sick marriage died. Kids were raised, kids were gone. We decided that we were going to divorce. That was in January of 1978. My partner of 7 years in a successful business in June of 1978 committed suicide. I want to tell you, folks, really got my attention. Because you know what I had to do? I had to take a look at me. I had to take a real close look at me. And you know what? I didn't like what I saw. I didn't like it at all. And I made some decisions in my life that things were going to change. And I took 30 days after that divorce, I took 30 days out of my life. I went back to Southern California to my dear friend and spent a month in his home. And you know what I did? I started back not at step four. I started back at step one. 19 years sober. Back to step one. And I want you to know, if you have the same kind of feelings going on inside you that I had going on inside me, I strongly suggest that you might consider doing the same thing. Because you see, what was very important in my life up until that day, up until that time, was what you thought about me. And I worked very diligently to have you think well of me. After that 30 days out in California and thoroughly doing a house clean, I came back to Atlanta, and I know that I was a different person. And the reason I know that is because it was more important to me what I thought about me than what you thought about me. Is that I was going to work an entirely different path than the path that I walked on before. And it was only by the grace of God that could take place. You know what it says in our book? Trust God, clean house, help others. See, before that, I was too busy to help others. I was too busy. You know what happened? It was I was no longer too busy. You know what I did? I had something to share with other people. And that was in the time in my life when I really wanted to share with other people. Because you see, other people had so freely shared with me from the very beginning, the sick, sick guy. And I got too busy making money and too busy in my life, in my own self-centeredness, to help other people. And that changed after that 30-day stint. Because you know what I discovered? I discovered that that's where my great joy really came from. You see, I now had a God in my life that was present on a daily basis. Not something I did in the morning and set it aside until the next morning. Something I carried with me 24 hours a day. I prayed in the car. I prayed in the bathrooms. I prayed in the offices. I prayed while I was on the telephone. I became a God-conscious kind of guy. And it was different in my life. And the reason for that is because the God that I came to understand was present in my life at all times. And I do believe that what happens to us is this. As we clean up the wreckage, not only of our past, but also of our sobriety, what happens is God's power takes its place. Sharing with other people in this program is what it's all about as far as I'm concerned. I do much better on a one-to-one basis than I ever did from up here. This is not something that I long to do. The things that I love to do is to work with people on a one-to-one basis. That's what it's all about. And you know, I found myself in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, if you get a divorce here and your conduct has not been real great, other people talk about you. And you know what? So be it. What I was on a different path. Those people didn't know I was on a different path. I knew I was on a different path. I didn't have to convince them that I had changed. My actions would convince them that I had changed. I was not the same guy. And you know, I didn't do anything any different. I went to my AA meetings, except what I did is I opened myself up to work with others. There's people in this room I don't have words to. I don't have words to describe it. They have touched my soul. And you know, I was fully convinced, bought a little home out in Lawrenceville, and I was fully convinced that what I was going to do is I was going to live in that little house by myself, and I was fine with that. That was just fine with me. As a matter of fact, one of my neighbors, when I was looking at the house, came in outside, and I'm walking around the house with the real estate agent, and she said, "You're going to buy the house?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "You're going to bring your family by?" And I said, "I don't have a family." She said, "Well, then why are you buying the house?" I said, "Well, I need a place to live. It looks pretty good." And you know what? I was doing just fine. And you know what? This little blonde lady came into my life. And you know what? She was a great friend. And I knew her in this program. She was great. She was a part of that crew that they talked about before over there with Kennedy and Hal. They were buddies over there. She talked about that before. And you know, we went to lunch together. Had to lunch together. And then we went to some plays together. And we started to date. And you know what, folks? I courted her. For the first time in my life, I did it right. And you know why I did it right? is because that's the way I wanted to do it. It didn't have a great deal to do with her. It had a great deal to do with what I wanted to do in my life. You know what? The more I got to know her, the more I got to realize what a true jewel she is. You who heard her Thursday night understand this exactly. And I saw that very early on. I saw how she reacted to her family. I saw how she was with her grandmother. Those are the things that were so valuable. This is the kind of person I wanted to spend my life with. But you know what, folks? I was terrified. I was terrified that I would go back and start living the way that I used to live. That's what I was afraid of. And that I would do this to this person that I loved so dearly. And that I would hurt her. And I was afraid of me, not afraid of her. And you know, I got a chance to introduce her to my family, my brother. And my father was still alive at that time. He was 90 years old. And I was in England with my brother, and she flew up for my niece's wedding. And my father saw her for the first time. And he grabbed a hold of her. He was a great hugger. And he gave her a hug, and he whispered into her ear. He said, "My kingdom for a blonde." You see, she had the same kind of relationship with her extended family that I did with my extended family. You know, that's good. That's good. Because you know what you do? You get a chance to see how people operate in their life. That's a very important thing to me. And you know what? One of the things that happened is we got to know each other. We got to know each other's families. And we began to talk about maybe getting married. Now, you know, my father was the kind of a guy, he had four sons in his family, and when you left home, you made your own decisions. Didn't come back to dad to make decisions for you. He didn't operate that way. But I didn't listen to that. I went up to Pennsylvania, and I was going to have a little meeting with father in the kitchen. That's where all the great business was always discussed, was in the kitchen. And I said to him, "Dad, there's something I want to talk to you about." And he said, "Yes, I know. You want to talk to me about Mary Emma." And I said, "How did you know?" He said, "What other reason would you have for being here?" And he said, "You know, I'm not going to make your decisions for you because that's what you came here for." He's a very wise guy. And I said, "Let me rephrase the question. If Mary Emma were in your life, what would you do?" He said, "I wouldn't let her get away." I said, "Thanks." And I went back home and proposed to my little blonde. And in October, many of you in this room were at that wedding. In October of 1982. And I know that there were people in our fellowship who said, "It'll never work. Not with that guy." Well, that was over 20 years ago. And apparently something must be working. Because you see, in our family, we have a lot of God in our family. And we have a lot of program in our family. And we have a lot of recovery in our family. I don't do her program. She doesn't do my program. She has her sponsor. I have my sponsor. I believe that that's important in recovery. Have I done things perfect in Alcoholics Anonymous? By no means. Have I done some things right? By the grace of God, I have. You know, last night was the first time that I ever stood up and was the last man standing. want you to know that I sat in many audiences and watched other people be the last man standing. And I often wondered what that would be like. And I want to tell you what it's like. It's very humbling. It's very humbling. Because you suddenly realize that God has showered blessings on my life. And many times I ignored that. Many times I never gave thanks for that. But it was different last night. I looked at Elaine Phelan, the wife of my sponsor of many years, and realized suddenly that the chain was there. And you know where that chain went to? The chain went from John Holmes to Joe Phelan to a guy by the name of Johnny Simons, who died in Gadsden, Alabama, working for Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company, whose sponsor was Dr. Bob. That was the chain. The chain of gratitude. And what do you do with gratitude? Is it just a word? I don't think so. I think if you're really grateful, show me. Show me. Leroy, who chaired this meeting, you know what he is? He's a giant in AA. He does all the unspectacular work. Not the great recognition, not the great podiums, not all the rest of that stuff. He does the great work, one by one, in his community. I have the utmost of respect for Leroy. He's a doer, folks. He's a doer, not a talker. He's a doer. And I feel very privileged to have had this opportunity this morning to thank you and the community here in Alcoholics Anonymous in Atlanta for giving me this opportunity to share with you my gratitude to each and every one of you. God bless you.